For listeners of this podcast since the beginning, you may recall in season one, I talked about how some of my best ideas come to me when I'm immersed in water. So today, I took myself to the pool and then I sat in the sauna. Lots of ideas, lots of memories came to the surface. I was reminded of sophomore year, 2004, college, my first kind of boyfriend, who I incidentally gave my virginity to. And he was a humanities scholar, a philosopher, if you will. And I remembered back then, or I remember today how I felt back then about the whole thing, which was very much an indoctrination of my immigrant working class parents, which was, you're going to go study something practical. What good can philosophy do for you, et cetera, et cetera. Anyway, that guy today runs a venture capital fund or a hedge fund or something out in Connecticut, absolutely loaded. But back then he was a philosopher and he would bury himself in -2, -3 of the WashU library, immersed in texts. And anyway, that's a fun intro because today we have a philosopher here, a fantastic philosopher, a man of many talents, if you will, also a poet. I'll do a proper bio in a bit, but that's a little bit funky.
So right? I'm introduced by you linking me to the man you incidentally, I quote, incidentally lost your virginity to.
How do you lose? Gave.
How does one give one's virginity away incidentally?
Well, I mean,
what's the incidental aspect of
incidentally,
this whole affair?
He happens to have been a philosopher and you're a philosopher. So
yeah, but that wasn't quite what you said. What you said is, incidentally, this is the person I gave my virginity to.
Well, I guess the incidentally was misplaced. I'm really speaking from the bottom of my heart here. Yes.
Is it?
What? Well, okay. Well, this is Jeremy Fogel on with us.
Hello, everybody. Hello, Amy. Hello, Dor. Hello, US of A.
Hello, Dad.
Hello, Dad. Who's Dad?
My dad.
Ah, hi, Dad. Do you know that your daughter gave her virginity away incidentally? That's quite
to a very attractive,
I'm sure he
young,
was.
Handsome. He looked like a better version of Bob Dylan, you know, with like the curls and the blue eyes. He was very, very, very handsome.
I don't think there's such a thing as a better version of Bob Dylan, to be fair.
He was, but honestly, I think there's a lot of versions that are better than Bob Dylan. I'm not the biggest Bob Dylan fan.
Aren't you?
I'm not.
All right. That's incidental then.
Today's episode is brought to us by Zahav Jewelry with 1L. Hi, and welcome to October 7th Emotionally Raw Coverage. Today is March 6th. It's the 152nd day of the war, and joining us is Jeremy Fogel, or should I say Dr. Jeremy Fogel, who teaches at Tel Aviv University's Department of Jewish Philosophy, as well as its School of Education. He is the academic director of ALMA, teaches at the Kibbutzim College of Education, Technology, and the Arts, and lectures publicly on philosophy in various forums. Jeremy holds a bachelor's degree in philosophy from the University of Cambridge and a master's degree and doctorate in philosophy from Tel Aviv University. His doctoral research explored the tension between universalism and particularism in modern Jewish philosophy, focusing on the Jewish-German philosophers Moses Mendelssohn and Hermann Cohen.
This is going to give the wrong impression, I fear. I think this bio is going to give the wrong impression. But please go on. I didn't mean to interrupt.
And he continued exploring these issues as a postdoctoral fellow at
Hamburg University. Yes, he did.
He's involved with several independent artistic...
He explored the issues.
He's involved with several independent...
Woke up in the morning, explored the issues, went out for lunch, and then explored the issues some more.
I recall asking you before this whether I could use this bio.
Yeah, no, it's also somewhat out of date. Please continue.
His first book, Tel Aviv is Water,
yes,
and Other Caesidian Thoughts, was,
yes,
published by Haba Lahaba in 2019.
Haba Lahaba.
And a few months ago, his book, Jewish Universalisms, Mendelssohn, Cohen, and Humanity's Highest Good, was released. He also is the co-host and co-creator of the Think and Drink Different podcast, which is in Hebrew for our,
yes,
Hebrew listeners.
Just host. Co-creator, but just host.
He's a wild card.
I'm a wild card.
I've been very excited about today's meeting, but I've also been a little nervous because...
Why?
Because we did not prep. I like doing a prep call before.
Do you now?
I do. And you were very evasive and mysterious.
I am.
So this is like Dore's wet dream because I came in with like no pieces of paper today. And this is just going to be like way from the bottom of my heart. I don't know how much you're going to enjoy, Jeremy, but I'm also kind of wild and feral.
So I am both Dore's wet dream as well as linked intrinsically to the person you incidentally gave your virginity to. This is a lot of pressure, I feel.
You've been into Freud lately, so this is a lot of sex on the brain. You should be enjoying this tremendously.
Well, you know, I'm just taking note of the facts.
Well, recently I attended two of your lectures at Beit Radical,
yes,
which has an agenda that relates to dealing with, you know, calamities, but having a positive mindset about the future, blah, blah, blah. You were outstanding.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's very kind of you.
I would describe your lectures as like, first of all, I'll say this. It was great to have an alternative sort of date night, you know?
Indeed.
It used to be
I do all the talking, you know, it takes the talking, the burden of talking is swept away from the couple.
Exactly. Also, and there's this other thing of like, oh, we went to a lecture. You know, it's not like, oh, we just went to the bar and sat around, or oh, we just like went to blah, blah, blah. We went to a lecture. We elevated our brains. And it's also hilarious. Like, you are funny as fuck.
Thank you.
You rode in on a bicycle.
Yes. I think that was, yes. That was incidental though.
He is not going to let me live it down. The word of the day is incidental. I-N-C-I-D-E-N-T-A-L. Incidental.
Yes.
Yes.
Interesting word.
Interesting. Why is it so interesting?
What does it
you?
Actually mean, incidental?
Well, what's the you opposite seem to know, so why don't you tell us?
Well, you're the one who introduced the words.
Well, you're the one harping on it, so why don't you talk about it?
I don't know. What does it mean to you, Amy?
Do you want me to look it up?
Please.
Okay, I'll do it. Do, 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 do. Accompanying, but not a major part of something. Liable to happen as a consequence of an activity. Okay, maybe it was the wrong use of the word.
I don't think
whatever.
It was.
Maybe it was. I don't know.
So what are we talking about then?
Well, you know, I can tell you what's on my mind
lately.
Please, but
please.
On my mind? Really? Yes. You don't want to go with what's on your mind?
No, all right. No, let's roll.
So after the pool sauna, my way home, I was like, you know what? I listened to music this morning when I was working on the socials for the pod. Why don't I finish listening to that episode of Barry Weiss's podcast, Honestly, that came out a few weeks ago. It's an episode where she's meeting up with Abigail Schreier.
Hey, Barry. Hey, Abigail.
Hey, guys. So the episode title is Why the Kids Aren't All Right. And it's about how, like, you know, the kids in America, they're being smothered with all the preventative mental health stuff and the talk about trauma and all this different stuff, like the social emotional learning and blah, blah, blah. And I was like along for the ride in part one, but part two kind of careened off a cliff and really lost me and also pissed me off. So that's kind of what's on my mind. Should I unpack that some more? Or do you want to talk about what's on your mind? I'll unpack it some more. Okay. There's two things there that were said. One thing was like, well, whatever makes your kids stronger will make them happier. And like, you know, it was an hour and 20 minutes where the word resilience wasn't used once. And that's definitely the word of the war in Israel. Chosen, resilience, strength, power. And she was basically saying the body keeps the score, that bestseller on the New York Times bestseller list, like 2 million copies sold, that whole thing about epigenetic trauma, that trauma lives in our bones. It's bullshit. Mm. That's her thesis. It's bullshit. We're basically traumatizing people with too much mental health. The kids can't function for themselves, blah, 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 blah. And then she's just like, let's take a look at Israeli combat soldiers for a second. Israeli combat soldiers have less PTSD than American combat soldiers. And that's because they have better ways of coping with it. And as the daughter, hey dad, I love you. as the daughter of a combat veteran who definitely, dad, we've talked about this, has, you know, PTSD that he doesn't want to talk about. I was just like fucking irate listening to this shit. I'm like, she's looking at us while we're in a war to like write her like controversial best-selling whatever book. And she's basically saying in Israel, people have stronger mental health. In Israel, the combat soldiers are stronger too. And it's because they keep going and they're stronger. And I'm like, No, it's actually because we didn't have the luxury of like unpacking our trauma. We don't have that space because it's not like a war that happened 50 years ago. And it's not a war that only, it's like every generation has to go into a war. And then you don't feel like you have the luxury of even going to mental health. Like in my family, there's a huge stigma about going to a psychologist or whatever. Even when I had an eating disorder, like full-fledged anorexia, was like, don't go to a psychologist. It'll be on your record. You're strong. You're not a weak person. So this whole idea of like, we're going to look at a completely different culture in a different country, and then we're going to extrapolate a few things that's going to help my thesis, really pissed me off. Because like, ultimately, I mean, I can imagine my father likes to say this, hey, how are you? And then like, if someone asks you, how are you? You tell them, better. And then they say, better why? And then you say, well, today is better than yesterday, and tomorrow will be better than today. Like, that's my parents' mindset. I don't know if it's necessarily a better mindset. Like, I don't know. I'm thinking about it, and it's like, everyone's looking at us as, oh, they're so resilient, and they're just keeping on. But it's like, actually, we have tons of health issues that we're still unpacking. Like, we have no idea where endometriosis is linked to stress. Like, my friends are all telling me that they're like been sicker this winter, or that they're having all sorts of body ailments. Like, I landed up in the fucking hospital in January. I don't know. So that's like on my mind, this kind of like rose colored glasses at like Israel from outside and saying like, oh, we're stronger, or we have a better way of dealing with things. We just don't have the resources like at an economic level in the country or anything else. Like, I just, it really pissed me off.
Does one ask questions in this podcast? What's the format?
You asked me what was on my mind.
No,
I told
actually,
I asked you what was in your mind. Then you told me what's on my mind.
Well, that's, you know. No, but yes. No, keep on. That was nice. That was interesting.
Yeah,
I feel that you're trying to pick a fight with Barry. Do you
know
Barry personally?
I'm not trying to pick a fight with Barry. If anything, it would be directed at Abigail.
Abigail. You don't like Abigail.
No, I mean, it's not Abigail? That I don't. It's not that I don't like her.
Fucking Abigail with her bullshit ideas.
It's not that I don't like her. It's just this whole idea that like, oh, we're going to be like better off or like more well adjusted.
I'll tell you what.
Like, kids are in like fucking safe rooms. Like in Sderot, they displaced people. They were displaced for like 4.5 months, and they're sent back to Sderot. They're back in school. Then they have like air raid sirens, and everyone's like, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger, and whatever makes you stronger makes you happier. And like, look at Israel. That's a great, like, we're the model
fucking
now? Like,
Abigail with her bullshit ideas.
I don't, Abigail, look, a respect, a researcher, and whatever. I'm just saying, don't, you know, you're the reason that there might be less PTSD here is because there might be less documented PTSD. That's it.
You
that's
know,
my point.
I'll you know, I don't know. I don't know the research. I don't know the statistics, but I would, you know, maybe I'm in this thing now where everybody's right. You know, maybe both Amy, you know, you might be right, and Abigail, bless her heart and bless her soul, she might be right as well. And I think that and again, I'm not an expert on American society, but I would guess that the moment anything becomes something that is that you can sell, right? And if mental health becomes a product, then it will be provided to people beyond what, strictly speaking, might be good for their health, just because there's gains, financial gains to be made, right? So she might be right in the sense that the moment mental health becomes a product, given the way American society is structured, it will be pushed down everybody's throat for financial gains. That might be the case. And it might also be the case that PTSD in Israel is underdiagnosed, and that people here are just as traumatic as, or just as traumatized as anywhere else, or perhaps more so given recent history and not so recent history. I'm in this thing now where everybody's right. There's truth in every perspective. And maybe it's because of this current obsession with the word conceptia in Israel, where everybody's talking about the conception. We were wrong-headed about the nature of our geopolitical situation, and it's all about the conception. I don't know if people, our friends in the English-speaking world, are as aware as we are of how obsessive the current Israeli discourse is with that one term, right? Conceptia. I think that's quite an interesting, philosophically, it's an invitation for philosophical thought in a way. Everybody's talking in Israel about conceptia, right? The conception. the conception is the big mental enemy of the Israeli state. You know, everyone who's wrong, the way to say that you're wrong-headed or that your ideas suck, you say you're still stuck in the conception, in the pre-7th of October conception. And it's an interesting question to ask, what does it mean to think without a conception, right? What is that? What do people mean when they say conception? And why is it harmful to our ability to perceive reality and to act according to what the facts are or to what reality really demands? And it seems to me that conception is really a worldview, right? You have so much worldview, you don't actually view the world anymore. Because, you know, in our actual awful events over here, you had young soldiers, you know, young girls, you know, young women soldiers perceiving with their eyes Hamas training for an attack, providing that intel to higher-ups, and they being stuck in the conception that they wouldn't attack, that they've got no interest to attack, that they're not seeking to attack, missed on the empirical data, did not look at the empirical data, but because they were so stuck in their own conception. So conception, really, when we use it in this meaning, in this sense, in current Israeli discourse, is a situation whereby you're so in love with your own theoretical appraisal of things, you're so in love with your own worldview that you do not see the actual empirical evidence before your eyes. And so the question is how to stop thinking through conceptions, through worldviews, and which is very difficult because I don't think it's possible. We don't have access to the world as it is in and of itself. We are always looking through a certain perspective. We're always looking through a certain interpretation. But at the very least, we should try to engage with different perspectives and not only see things only through our own perspective. So to accept complexity, I think, is the opposite of thinking through a conception. For example, if I think about the reasons why the Gazan society developed in a way that turned murderous on the 7th of October, I've got a lot of appreciation for Marxist thought. I like Marx a lot. I think that Marx was right about many things, and I think that part of the grand catastrophe, which is human civilization at the moment, is related to dynamics that he already perceived in the 19th century. So Marx would always say, go to the material substrata, right? Go to see where the money goes, right? How the first, you know, human beings are firstly organisms that are seeking to feed themselves. That's the basic reality of our biological existence. We have to feed ourselves. We've got these needs that we are trying to meet. And so you have to think about the very basic, crude, vulgar, biological substrata of existence, and all the rest is built upon that. So first you look at the means of production. How does a society create the wealth it needs to answer its needs? That's the basic structure. These are the foundations, and all the rest is on top of it, right? Ideology, religion, belief systems, entertainment, it's all on top of a basic substrata. And if you want to really change, you have to change that. Right, that's always the question you want to ask. So, for example, human nature is not some kind of essential, never-changing fact. It's a function of what the means of production of any given society are. So if we look at Gaza, right, it's a society where in order to succeed, you have to be part of Hamas. That's basically where the money is, right? Also because of what our governments have been doing throughout the years, which is, you know, allowing this organization to grow and to grow rich and to become really essentially the sole source of sustenance and money in Gaza. So obviously, if the only way to make money, to feed my family, is to become a Hamasnik, I'll become a Hamasnik, and I generally will also adhere to the, you know, nihilistic ideology and fundamentalism, and I will be part of this whole party, right? Of this whole event. Now, that's Marxist way of thinking. So if we would change the means of production, if the way to succeed in Gazan society would not be would not demand of me to be part of Hamas, people might develop in other ways, but you have to change the means of production. Now, if you think of a different perspective, you've got, for example, Freud, right? You know, the repression of sexual and violent urges, the way that's mismanaged usually in very conservative societies, and, you know, the way it comes out in perverted ways, for example, also on the 7th of October. That's also an interesting, it's a very different way of looking at it, but it's also interesting. Also interesting, someone that completely contradicts Marx, maybe someone like Weber, you know, who talked about Protestantism and the spirit of capitalism, which is the complete opposite of Marx, because Weber says that for capitalism to evolve, you needed to have an ideology. You needed to have the Protestant view of the world and the Protestant values. And the moment these things occurred in Western history, then you had the space in which capitalism could evolve, which is the opposite of what Marx says, because Marx says it always starts down, right? It always begins with the means of production. It always begins with like the material elements. And Weber says, no, you know, here we have a grand example where the ideology is the one that causes a change in the means of production. And I say both are right, or at the very least, both are perspectives from which it is interesting to look at the situation in order not to be stuck in any one conception. It is both the case that it could be insightful to analyze, for example, you know, Gazan society or Israeli society or American society from a Marxist perspective. And it might also be the case that it's interesting to think about it with completely different glasses in terms of ideology, right? Because, you know, specifically thinking about Hamas, there's also a wider ideological issue relating to fundamentalist Islam, you know, just like there's a fundamentalist Jewish problem or fundamentalist Christian problem. It's not unique to Islam, but it's perhaps particularly relevant to us at the moment. So I'm trying to think about issues from various perspectives. And going back to our dearly beloved Abigail, that's why I'm thinking there might be something in what she's saying, and there might also be something in what you're saying. Both are insightful. So you can live at peace, Amy, with Abigail. You don't have to, you can leave that ill feeling towards Abigail. You don't have to be angry at Abigail anymore. Though, what's with the directing? If you want to say something, fucking say it. What's with the fucking the maestro directing symphony here?
The thing is, when you do this music transaction, it's really easy to edit after, because you can start a new conversation from any point if you don't like it. And if there is an energy in the room that the subject is like ending, so I think you don't need... That's enough. We can go to the next subject, if I feel that.
All right. So you can also say, let's go to the next subject.
This is
you exist. You can be part of this conversation, though.
We don't have three microphones.
Yeah,
and we are emotionally raw.
That's
coverage,
very disappointing of yours, though. I would expect you to be a man with three microphones.
I don't have ill will towards Abigail.
No, there
I actually,
is.
Listen,
incidentally.
Hold on. I was like, you know what? I'm not going to talk about this. And then I listened to the last 2 minutes, like just before I got here.
Right.
And Barry's like, you know, you touch the third rail of like being canceled and like what keeps you going. And she's like, well, you know, I'm just like out there on my mission for the truth.
Right.
Now I'm with you. Okay. We're all in the forest and every one of us is doing something else in the forest. Me, right?
I like
dyeing fabric with like pigments that I take from nature. Okay.
Sure.
Like I dyed this with onion skins, the
really?
Shirt I'm wearing. Yeah.
It was white originally?
Yeah, it was white.
Yeah, it's very beautiful.
Thank you very much. So if we were in the forest, right?
Right.
I'd probably be like taking pictures of the flowers and collecting the eucalyptus bark. And you might be thinking about whatever you're thinking about and we're all going to do different things in this forest. And the forest is existence. Okay. We can all coexist. I'm with you.
And Abigail would be burning the forest down.
No, I'm not going
to
burn her down.
To
but if someone's coming at me
lot.
And they're saying, my overarching principle, the thing that gets me going is that I'm looking for this concept of truth. Now, I'm not a post-truther or a pre-truther. It's just not my prevailing value system or the thing that like I've put as a priority, because I'm more of like a wisdom-based oriented person than like a knowledge-oriented person. But if someone's coming out there and on the air saying like, this is absolutely true and this is a thing, I feel, not to think for a second, we'll come back to that too. I feel that it's not really an accurate depiction of what's going on. Then I feel like, you know what, I'm going to say something about it. And I respect her for doing it. I respect her for researching.
What does Abigail represent to you?
It's not a matter of Abigail. No, it's not.
Oh, yes, it is.
You're not a psychologist. You are a philosopher, all right? And but all the PNP in the world.
The psychological phenomena is so obvious.
Conception. Hold on. Regarding conception. No, because I resent the idea that, because I grew up in a house with this. I grew up in like third generation Holocaust, second generation combat PTSD. And then for someone to be like, oh, your experience was hunky-dory and you didn't really like
have someone.
It's someone who's on the air speaking authoritatively.
Abigail. No, do you have any Abigails in your family?
Her name could be Bill Smith. I don't give a fuck what her name is or who she is.
Do you have any Abigails in your family?
No. Why are you so harping on this?
Did Abigail date the philosopher you gave your virginity to incidentally back in sophomore year?
Let's call him John. And no, I think he settled down college. Washington University St. Louis. So
St. Louis?
Regarding the conception.
Please.
I thought about this before that like, you know, everyone keeps talking about the conception, but there's one very famous conception, which is the Immaculate Conception of Mary.
Right.
You know, that also happened here in Israel.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Well, I mean, where was Mary? Where was Jesus born?
I'm sure she was here. The question whether the conception was indeed immaculate.
Well, I mean, that's what it's referred to. It's the Immaculate Conception.
Right, but it's a question whether factually Jesus was created without physical intercourse.
Yes, but let's assume that, I mean, the concept. The concept is the Immaculate Conception.
Yes,
that's
it
what
is.
It's called.
Yes.
And it's that concept. How do we look at years? It's like the years after Jesus and before Jesus. And so it's kind of interesting that the kind of big bang, if you will, of the Gregorian calendar is this Immaculate
Virgin.
Conception.
We're back talking about virginity.
Well, I guess
the incidental giving away of it.
Yeah, it's all a matter of, you know, creation, thought, conception. it's all related.
Yes, it is.
And then we wonder a lot about how we can get people to think differently. And I keep returning to this theme in our show of feeling. You know, everyone's like in their head space, but like, how can we get them into their heart space? And it's really nutty. Like, okay, let's go with that for a second, that everyone's telling like the truth or everyone's right or we're all coexisting. Lately, I've been thinking about how, you know, Hamas just said that they don't know where the hostages are. I don't know if you caught that. That happened a few days ago, but they know with certainty that like 30,000 people are dead. Like they just know. They knew after the hospital thing that it was like 500. Like there's this weird thing going on right now with like things that are presented as factual certainties and things that are just uncertain or unclear. And then all of these things are like in a mishmash and almost no one is just saying like, Hey guys, how do you know that? And you don't know where like 130 people are right now.
Right.
So it's a very weird time.
It is.
And you didn't live in the States, right?
For a while, actually.
You did?
For three beautiful, wonderful, lovely, amazing months. Yes.
Where?
New York.
You were in New York City?
New York. Yes, I was in New York.
That's where I was born.
It's a great, you know, one of the greatest cities on earth. No questions about it.
So 3 months aside, that was a nice extended stay, but I'm sure you've seen what's...
I got kicked out, unfortunately.
You got kicked out of New York?
I was going to stay. Yeah, I got kicked out at the time. Yeah. Some minor immigration problem at Atlanta Airport.
Well, that's unfortunate. They kicked you out, which is a shame, but they haven't kicked out all the nutties blocking the bridges and, you know, saying that Israel's committing genocide and all the stuff going on there. Have you been following what's happening there?
Well, I think generally the wider problem in America is that it might be ruled soon by an orange rapist who's going to put an end to the liberal democratic world order. I think that's more concerning if I were American than, you know, a bunch of kids shouting against Israel. I think
the interesting thing, though, is that these kids shouting against Israel, the progressive leftists are bringing down Biden in the polls right now. Yeah. So if Trump does, if
I don't think it's
liberal,
only them.
If like a liberal Democrat, whatever, is like undone, and that's the end of it. I just want to say, like, uh-huh. I'm not making this up. Like, progressives will have something to do with it.
Sure.
Which is crazy if you think about it.
It's like Leonard Cohen's got this great little poem with a drawing. He says, "Oh, and by the way, you will not like what comes after America."
When I was there in April 2022 for an extended stay, like, it was the longest I had been in New York since I left New York in 2010.
Uh-huh.
I was there for a month. And I had this sensation that I was really experiencing the fall of Rome.
Hmm. The fact that it's two, you know, somewhat that, you know, the fact that there's two very elderly, you know, with diminishing cognitive abilities, men running against each other, really does seem like some kind of grotesque fall of Rome scenario. Two like half demented old men, one of whom is just an absolute narcissist, rapist. The other one, you know, seems like a nice guy, but my grandma calls him the Pager. He looks like a corpse. Joe, I wish him all the well. You know, I wish it's my personal interest for him to, for his team. I think people vote for the team. I think people trust that he has a good team. But it is a kind of end of Rome decadence thing. And then, you know, just the fact that the entertainment industry has taken over politics, that the reality TV star is becoming president, is, I think, a sign of cultural decline, generally speaking.
Whereas here, I mean, maybe we don't have enough people from the entertainment industry coming into
anyone, politics. I'd take anyone. I'd take the clown from the circus against that, you know, gentleman in charge at the moment.
Personally, I want to see Danny Cushmara running things.
Fine by me. Let Danny run, anyone. Let the guy who runs the corner store here run the country rather than Mr. Netanyahu.
Have you heard that what's really popular with these youngins that are just like running around?
The youngins.
Yeah, the youngins. I don't know what else to call them. You know, like I thought it was, I'm 38 uh-huh. and I feel pretty young.
Right.
You know,
touch wood.
I feel pretty young. Like I'm young at heart. But Now I'm just like, it's been 20 years since my rendezvous with the philosopher.
Right.
Is that the right use of the word rendezvous?
Sure.
Now I feel really self-conscious my use of words generally.
Yeah.
I'm like, are these words the right words? But anyway, it's been like, it's been almost 20 years since I graduated college. Like that's crazy.
Amy, that's interesting about this whole philosopher. The presence of this philosopher is a purely sexual presence in our conversation.
No, we dated. We were really into each other.
But there was it's not like you started from this philosopher and then we went talking about ideas.
But I wanted to ask you,
ideas.
You started harping on the thing. I wanted to talk to you about, you know, philosophy and its function
right.
in our lives. Like is it something useful, you know,
right.
to counter?
If you wanted to ask me about philosophy, why didn't you? Has anyone been
You've been appeared
up?
At some
is
point.
It,
no,
is
I'm
it?
Kidding. I'm not going to blame. We're not into the blame game here on Emotionally Raw Coverage, but I do.
That's the name
actually,
of the podcast?
Emotionally Raw Coverage.
Emotionally
yeah.
Raw Coverage?
Yeah.
Right. You don't believe in questions also?
Actually, I don't know if you heard our podcast,
it's a very question based format.
Dora, can you please explain what we're doing on season 3? Because in season two, we were doing questions.
I'm having a great time.
And it was like an interview.
I'm not complaining.
And then Dora was like,
Amy,
we want to have a little bit more of the
but
Amy on. Let's take it more to a conversation.
Generally, you know, if you bring up the philosopher, the figure of the philosopher does not function in this conversation as a vehicle of thought. It's a very animalistic, purely sexual figure in this conversation, which is an interesting twist. It's unexpected, you know? You know, it's not like, I had a friend who was a philosopher and we talked about Plato and then we're going to be talking about Plato. So Jerry, what do you think about Plato? It's like, you remind me of this person I had sex with. And he's a philosopher, but that's incidental, right? Him being a philosopher in a way It's really him being a sexual agent.
No, what I said was, incidentally, he was a philosopher, and that what came to mind was right. this thing from like my working class parents when I went off to college that was like, you're going to go study something practical. And ultimately, I ended up going to law school and was like, practical, practical, practical. But now, like, and I've gone to two of your lectures, it's like, philosophy has so much relevance for our lives today and for processing this stuff.
Of course it does.
And it's different than psychology and the whole like trauma industry.
Right.
And maybe, you know, we'll just cut to the questions. Dora, we're still striking a balance, right? You wanted a little bit less of just the straight. We used to do like a straight shot interview format and it was really
No, but Q&A. I think this might be the best podcast ever.
Welcome to this week's edition of
Solid Gold.
We had invited Dr. Jeremy Fogel onto Solid Gold, but it was frankly unshareable. So we're going to do it on our own.
It was like dirty and maybe a fuch al fuch. I don't know how to say it in proper English.
It was like, it was like reverse psychology, you know. Like reverse psychology? Is that kind of...
Yeah, I think it is.
It's like the upside down.
Actually, I love this commercial, but I think it's not... it's inappropriate.
I feel like, yeah, it's a little too risky, a little dicey. Isn't that great? Now you guys are all going to be like, what did he say?
Because I heard that their jewelry... That's what I heard. That's what I heard. I heard that it literally... Like... That's literally... that Zehavi, they were called. I literally been told that it...
Maybe we can describe the gentleman on this episode if you want to talk about fashion.
Jeremy has fantastic fashion. He's not here, actually. He just left. So this is going to be a surprise for him. I love the way that Jeremy dresses. He does a sock in, a sandal slide, like an Adidas sandal
flip
slide.
Flop.
No, a flip-flop door is when it has the little thing between the big toe and the second toe.
This is the, okay.
But the Adidas style is called a slide because you slide your foot into it.
Ooh,
isn't
okay.
that great? I love a good slide.
But let's speak about
Jeremy.
The
getting back to Jeremy. He usually wears a button-down shirt. He's quite tall.
Very tall.
Very tall. He's taller than you, I think.
No, I think we are the same. But he's more like... his body is more present in it, like... It's more solid, like solid gold.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, but it's not hard for him to be more solid than you. You are pretty lanky.
Okay, what else? He has a necklace and glasses. And he has this great hair.
Great hair. Great head of hair.
He's a very impressive man.
Yes, he is. He's a very attractive, very intelligent man. Visit ZehavJewelry.com for gold body jewelry. Made in New York. If you don't have a piercing, that's not a problem. Use discount code DOOR24 for an additional 35% off your entire order. If you use this coupon code and it's your first time purchasing, they'll even throw in a free pair of solid gold 14 karat earrings with your first order. And completely unrelated to jewelry and everything, I just want to say, rest in peace, Richard Lewis. And thanks for listening to this week's episode of Solid Gold. Stay shiny. Did you know that Herzl was really into Wagner?
Was he?
Yeah. Oh.
Sexually, you mean?
Sex sells, doesn't it?
Does it? I think somewhat, you know. Herzl. You know that Herzl was manic depressive?
That makes sense.
Yeah. Not only that, the Herzl family is a terrible, tragic story. Yeah,
I read the biography. I know. Why don't you tell her?
Well, you know, he was manic depressive. And basically, like, you know, a few weeks even before he embraced Zionism, he thought it was a ridiculous idea. And then he had this mania. In June, he's writing like mathematical calculations in his journals, you know, just to make sure that he's sane because he has all these great ideas. He's going to be a world figure. He's going to be a grand leader. And so essentially, you know, really in a way, Israel is the result of the manic episode, of an epic manic episode from, you know, by Theodore. His wife was in and out of mental institutions. His daughter died from an opium overdose, which, you know, was rarer at the time than it is now. Her brother, his son, killed himself when she died. I think he had another daughter that was murdered by the Nazis, but she too had mental health issues, and her son killed himself. So it's a very somber, pretty dark family history.
There's no continuation of his bloodline.
No, everybody's either dead or, you know, from suicide or, yeah, otherwise.
I want to ask you about the philosophy thing now, but I also wanted to ask you if you've seen the movie Zone of Interest. Did you hear about this movie?
No.
It's a new movie from Jonathan Glazer. Just saw it last week. And it's a Holocaust movie, but not in the traditional sense of a Holocaust movie.
I've heard about it.
Have you heard about it? I don't want to give any spoilers, but I was just curious as to whether you've seen it. It's fantastic. Everyone should go see it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Or, you know, watch it at home.
Sure.
But philosophy.
Yes.
Mr. Philosopher.
Philosopher. Oh, Mr. Philosopher.
Dr. Philosopher. Do you feel comfortable calling yourself doctor, or do you have like as
you know, actually I think for some I went to visit a friend, so I, you know, I haven't flown in a long time, and you have Mr. and Mrs. Doctor on the plane ticket. So that's the first, you know, I think it was the first time I flew as a doctor, and I was thinking, what why is that thing there? It's such random.
On a plane of all places, they're going to be like, is there a doctor on the plane? Is there a doctor on the plane? And then she'll look at the like list of the Dr. Fogel, Dr.
No, but
Fogel.
I think they say professor also. You can choose your academic, you know, like rank on the plane ticket, which is weird. You know, why would it be relevant?
I'm also a doctor, by the way.
Are you?
Yeah, I'm a Juris Doctor.
Oh, wow.
There was an ethics decision in New York that I can call myself. You know, there was a lawyer in New York City and he was like, I want to call myself a doctor too. And then people were like, no, you shouldn't, blah, blah, blah. There was an ethics decision. Ruling is, I can call myself doctor. My sister's actually a medical doctor.
Is she?
Yeah, so I feel like
so there's
an
a lawyer
asshole calling
and a
myself
doctor
and
the,
a vet.
And a vet.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, your parents must be proud.
They are proud.
I'm sure they are.
There's two more brothers also who are doing great things.
So. Are they?
Yeah. Huh. But I'm not really practicing as a lawyer anymore. But anyway,
sure.
Dr. Philosopher.
Yes.
How can philosophy enrich our lives and help us deal with this maelstrom of emotions and intellectual complexity?
Well, you know, I think that generally speaking, the philosophy has, you know, this is something also that I was thinking in this, you know, awful times that we're living here at the moment. If philosophy can't respond to times of crisis, then really it has very little value. I think that if philosophy doesn't actually bring something existential to the table, then, you know, it's not the kind of philosophy that I'm really interested in. It's certainly not the kind of philosophy that, for example, the originative philosophers of the Western tradition in ancient Greece were interested in. You know, Epicurus, it's weird because I'm always giving these lectures in Hebrew, so now I have to find the words in English, but you know, Epicurus has this very beautiful phrase where he says, just like there's no value in medicine if it doesn't expel the suffering of the body, so there's no value in philosophy if it doesn't expel the suffering from the mind. And that's something that it's a sentiment I very much agree with. You know, Nietzsche says something, you know, rather similar when he says that the only examination of philosophical ideas that carries any meaning is the question of whether someone can live in their light. If not, it's just words upon words upon words. It's just empty criticisms of words. He thinks, incidentally, that that's what academic philosophy is mainly about, right? It's just this, you know, maybe joy, you know, it might be a satisfying cognitive masturbation of some kind. You know, it could be like some chess game that scholars play with each other, but it doesn't carry the existential meaning, the profound life-changing, life-altering meaning that philosophy should be carrying in Nietzsche's perspective, which is a very ancient Greek perspective. In ancient Greece, the philosophers, you were a philosopher not so much by virtue of proposing some new theoretical construct, certainly not in virtue of having done a degree where I, you know, oh, look at me, I got like an A plus on my class in ethics, but I'm an asshole, but you know, I got an A plus on my class. Or, you know, I flunked metaphysics. You know, that's not at all the kind of activity we're talking about. You know, the kind of activity they were engaging is much nearer to what maybe we would think of as a spiritual path or a religious sect of some kind, not in the negative connotation of the word sect, in the sense of an attempt at living a life that is good and meaningful and fulfilling. You know, these were the originative questions and inquiries philosophers were engaged in. And I think that for philosophy to remain relevant, and I think it is, or it can be, because there's many different kind of philosophical activities that people can be engaged with. But the kind of philosophy that I'm most interested in, I think, and that most people are interested in, is those that do address these issues that you raise, you know? And I think, for example, for me, in this period, the philosophers that I like to go back to and read are the Stoic philosophers. So I've been going back and reading them and talking about them. And, you know, when they asked me to give lectures at, you know, refugees from the north or whoever other groups was asked to lecture to, I thought, you know, what can I be talking about in these times? And I thought that the Stoic philosophers give the most inspiring or appropriate or helpful, useful answers at this time.
Remind me, the Stoics were around 2,000 years ago?
Yes, indeed. Well, it's a long and storied school of thought, really, because it starts in the 4th century, Zenon, in the 4th century before the Common Era, and it keeps on going up to the Roman times until really Christianity takes over. And then it has a very formative impact on Christianity, and it remains an incredibly important source for Western thought more generally. But that's kind of the time where it was like a living, vibrant tradition that people actually lived, you know. And I mentioned Epicure, who's the kind of intellectual or philosophical rival of the Stoics. But both very much agree that philosophy is not about advancing new abstract theories. It's not even about, seeking the best or most cogent argument. It's about living a philosophical life. It's living in a certain way. You know, they saw Socrates as their... Socrates himself, of course, didn't think of himself as a Stoic. He was Socrates. But they think of Socrates as kind of an existential hero. And a lot of their wisdom, a lot of their advice, a lot of their directives, existential directives, are, I think, deeply appropriate for the current period and for times of uncertainty and times of suffering and pain and cruelty, which they would, I think, you know, pretty rightly say is, generally speaking, the human lot, you know?
I've often thought of myself as a modern Epicurean, but I really do find some solace amongst like the Stoic.
You know, the one, I had this one thing that gave me like a Satori moment, you know, where I was like, it literally released something in me, is that I read this quote by Seneca where he says that just like the soldier is tied with a chain to the prisoner he's carrying around, so fear and hope are tied together. They might seem like very different phenomenon, but really they are both symptoms of a mind that is not at rest, that is not at ease, right? And I think that's a very profound thought. I think that in Israel in particular, maybe more generally speaking in the West, we have this thing now where hope is really important. Hope is terribly important. We need hope to survive. It's a thing you find a lot in various Jewish sources. The Messiah, we're a messianic religion, right? So the Messiah will come. There's the hope for the Messiah. Next year in Jerusalem, Shana Haba BeYerushalayim HaBnuya, the rebuild Jerusalem, the anthem, you know, the Israeli anthem is the hope, Hatikva, right? And here Seneca says that hope is a nefarious thing. It's a symptom of not being in the present, not being in a space where you can find peace. Fear is projecting the past onto the present. Hope is evading the present for the future. Both are attempts at evading that which cannot really be evaded. And both, in a way, I think, are portrayed in Stoic thought as these efforts, these really hard efforts you have to engage in to avoid that which is unavoidable, in a way. And precisely by letting go of hope, you also let go of fear, and you find whatever peace is available in the present, which is another one of the mainstays of their thinking, to focus on the present moment, right? It's like Epictetus says in the beginning of his manual, about every single thing, ask yourself whether it is under my control or whether it isn't under my control. What is not under your control, you develop indifference towards. You focus on what you can control, which is always in the present. You have no control about the future. You have no control about the past. And if you look, especially in the beginning of the war, you know, if you watched on TV, everybody was always talking about the Hayom She'acharei, the day after, right? The day after, we'll have to start again. We'll have to change this. We'll have to do that. And it felt like each time people say the day after, it's like they had a psychological need to even say that term, because it's like you telling yourself there will be a day after. And the truth is, we don't know if there will be a day after. You know, there might be a day after without us, right? We might not be here to enjoy the day after. There might not be a day after, or the day after might be worse than the day that is currently happening. It's an illusory, you know, it's like a dopamine fix. You say the day after, you've got this moment of relief, but then immediately you're disappointed because you're not there yet. And, you know, maybe, and you know somewhere inside of yourself that you might not ever get there. And maybe just releasing even that attempt to hold on to the future and that attempt to stick to the past is a path towards that which really is under our control, you know, which is focusing on developing the kind of attitudes that enables to live with the least suffering possible. You know, they have this formative image that we are all dogs tied to a cart. Now, you have no control over where the cart is going to roll to. The cart could go to death, to life, to health, to sickness, to war, to peace, to richness, to poverty, to success, to failure. You've got absolutely, you know, you can try your best, but you have no control about the eventual result of your action. What you have control over is your own attitude. So you can choose to be a dog that goes, you can run with the cart with some cheer and some joy and some affirmation of life, or you can be dragged by the cart. Either way, you're going to go to where the cart is traveling. You might as well try to develop an attitude that doesn't add to the suffering that, you know, is the inevitable part of life, but you don't want to have the added suffering of fighting against what is inevitable, you know, the, namely the direction of the cart. So these kinds of thoughts, I think, are thoughts that are, if you talked about resilience, you know, that's what they're focused about, and that's what they have brought to people in the past. I take it very seriously. I think that people, you know, when you read Marcus Aurelius, for example, you know, it's one of the most beautiful aspects of the Stoic heritage, that among the great teachers in the Roman period, you have a freed slave, Epictetus, and you have the Roman Empire, you know, a god, a Roman Empire, and they both are really, and Marcus Aurelius sees in Epictetus a great teacher of his. He didn't know him personally, but, you know, he knows of him. And when you read his amazing book, Meditations or To Myself, he doesn't have a title because it's not really a book. It's his personal journal where he jots down his thoughts in Greek in the camp where he has to manage these awful wars that he had to oversee all the time against, you know, ancient Teutonic, you know, like Germanic tribes. I think that part of what is so touching is that this is really a sincere document of a person finding solace, finding strength and resilience in these principles of thought. And I think that's part of that which is so comforting, is the notion that someone like Marcus Aurelius, who had to deal with lots of the similar shit that we have to deal with, you know, I think he ruled from 161 to 180, if I'm not mistaken. He had the Antonine Plague. He had this awful pandemic, you know, millions of dead. He had to to engage in spite of the fact that he didn't even want to be emperor, and he certainly didn't want to spend his time fighting these battles against these awful battles against these Germanic tribes. That was his lot. That's where the cart went. And he dealt with it through, you know, developing this kind of stoic attitude. And when you read him, you read someone who had to deal with a lot of the same stuff that we had to deal with, you know, with a pandemic, which I guess in hindsight seems like a pink Barbie period of hugs and kisses. You know, it seems like a day at the park as opposed to the current catastrophe in Israel. And now we're dealing with this. And you know, it kind of drives home what they were saying, you know, in a way. Not that I don't like Epicurus. You know me, Amy. We know each other from beyond the... I think we can be honest with your listeners that we know each other from beyond the podcast. This is not the first time we have spoken to each other.
I thought you didn't like to get into the personal, Jeremy.
No, I don't. I think it's overblown. Everybody's talking about their personal stories, like, you know. I don't like that.
But I mean, I would love to say where I first met you.
Well, you know, that's not very... You met me at a public function, didn't you?
I'm at the Hubba back in the day with the harmonium.
No, but what I mean is that from our acquaintance, from our personal acquaintance, you know that, you know, that's something also Epictetus says, don't listen to what a philosopher says are his principles. See how he actually lives. And the way I actually live, and I'm happy to say it, is not... there's some Stoic elements here and there, but there's also a lot of Epicurean elements. You know,
I think we're hybrids.
We're hybrids. And bon vivant, you know. And I think, and one thing that I took from Epicurus, which to me is makes a lot of sense, is, you know, the classic demarcation between you've got like the natural pleasures and the unnatural pleasures. You know, Epicurus says, you know, the highest good is pleasure. We need to find pleasure. And there's natural pleasures. So there's necessary natural pleasures, like having a drink of water, sleeping, peeing. You know, these are very pleasurable activities without which you would die. So they're absolutely necessary. I always say to my students, your homework today is to really enjoy peeing. You know, really, like, be there when you pee, when you relieve yourself in the toilet, when you drink water, like, really enjoy it. Just go crazy on enjoying these necessary natural pleasures. And then you have unnecessary natural pleasures, things that you do not, strictly speaking, need to survive. But they're great, they're pleasure, like drinking a glass of wine or having some, maybe food that's a little bit more elaborate, or having sexual relationships, which might be necessary for the species, but are not necessary on an individual level. We could, technically speaking, survive without it. What you have to be careful of are in unnatural pleasures. And what does unnatural pleasure mean? It's the problem is not the pleasure, because pleasure is the highest good. The problem is that unnatural pleasures end up giving you more pain than they do pleasure. So if I become addicted to heroin, right, the suffering and the pain that I will bring upon myself is ultimately greater than the pleasure that it will provide me. That's why it's an unnatural pleasure. It's an imbalanced pleasure in a way. And I think that this kind of scientific, you know, which is scandalous at the time, because still in our culture, you know, pleasure is such a thing that is kind of, you know, on the one hand, we embrace it. On the other hand, you know, our religious heritage, the Judeo-Christian or some aspects of the Judeo-Christian heritage really condemned, you know, the search for pleasure. The very fact that Epicurus has kind of this like almost scientific attempt at classifying pleasures and at really finding the ways in which to manage, you know, your economy of pleasure in such a way as to make it the most pleasurable, I think is genius, you know? It's like with drugs, for example. Like, I always joke about the fact, you know, Dor's going to get involved in conversation, that if you think of your drug use from like an Epicurean perspective, you might be able to actually do much more drugs in the long run than if you'd go crazy, you know? You know what I mean? Because, like, you know, I think of myself somewhat, I'd like to be able, if God blesses me with a long life, to occasionally have, you know, lovely, wonderful, enriching experiences till the very end, you know? But for that to happen, you have to keep a certain balance, because if I'm going to go like crazy and start doing like an unbalanced amount of drugs, I'm not going to be able to enjoy them in the long run. But that's a side note. I don't want to talk about drugs. It's Dor. He made me talk about drugs. מה את אומרת, אמי? סגרנו את זה? גם, I think, shouldn't we try to tie it all together with the incidental and the virginity again, like somehow and reach closure?
It's amazing. A woman brings up sex, and then the man has sex on the brain and tries to be like, oh, you just have sex on the brain, but you've had sex on your brain the entire
podcast. No, you're the one. You literally said, you remind me of the person I gave my virginity to.
I did not say that you reminded me.
Of course you did.
I said that in the pool earlier, I remembered.
Right.
Listen, balance is important, as you said. I'm happy to be a hybrid Epicurean Stoic and to be in the company of such a fine Epicurean Stoic.
A specimen.
Dor is making the wave sign as if it's a tsunami warning sign. He's like, guys, rap. Jeremy, it's been such a pleasure. Really, it has been.
Thank you. Thank
such
you.
A
it's
pleasure.
Been a great pleasure for me too to be part of this wonderful podcast, the Raw Emotion, Raw Emotional Report.
Raw Emotion, Raw. Now I forgot the name of our podcast.
What's the name?
Emotionally Raw Coverage.
Emotionally Raw Coverage.
And I'll say about the hope thing.
Please.
It's just something we've said in a previous episode. Dor doesn't like the tikva, okay?
Hmm.
And that came up in a conversation which was pretty windy about hope. But I said, I don't need to have hope that things are going to change because things are changing all the time.
Right.
Impermanence is the thing. And so...
I guess the hope
is
that they're changing for the better.
I'll say I don't hope that you come back to the pod.
I'll be delighted to come back to the pod.
Exactly. That's what I was going for. And then, you know, so we don't really need to tidy, close all the ends. The name of my studio is Loose.
Loose Ends?
Loose.
Because, yeah, it's like...
Because keep it loose, you know, stay loose.
Unseinfeld end. You know, we didn't tie the whole thing together, I feel.
Adam at the cafe that we bleep out, he's one of the owners. We have an extended conversation over the past 2 years. It doesn't really begin and it doesn't really end. I see him every few days and it's just like another thread in the conversation. So,
threads. We've just unthreaded something.
It's going to be a stay safe, stay tuned, stay loose kind of vibe
today.
Stay
loose.
Stay loose. And
especially Abigail. Stay loose, Abigail.
Why? It's like tsunami waves coming from all directions.
Yes.
Dor with the hands today. All right. Thank you so much, Jeremy. Thank you to our listeners.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. No,
thank
you.
You. Thank you, listeners, for listening to us.
Yeah, thank you.
If this is your first time tuning in, we invite you to go back.
If this
back.
Is the first time, it's probably going to be the last time, to be
what?
Fair.
No.
Let's face it.
No.